From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, ISIS and American war powers, Ukraine ceasefire, killings, and a cry of hate crime in North Carolina, and lots of media news. Brian Williams suspended. President Obama asked Congress for war powers authorization against the so-called Islamic State, said it won't be like the country's last wars.
It is not the authorization of another ground war, like Afghanistan or Iraq.
After hard talks, a ceasefire agreement, but little confidence with Russian tanks in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin.
In spite of all the difficulties of the negotiations, we have managed to reach an agreement upon the most important thing. Why did we have to talk for so long?
And three young Muslim Americans murdered in North Carolina. Funeral prayers here yesterday. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Youssef from The Daily Beast, Brian Tao from The Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us today from Washington is Nancy Youssef, senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, Brian Tao joins us, White House and politics reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Byron.
Nancy, you know the Middle East very well, and I want to go to the news that is topping some of the news reports right now, that we have ISIS fighters at the gates of the base outside Baghdad, where U.S. Marines are quartered and, I guess, training Iraqi army troops. What's going on here, Nancy? This is the Baghdad airport we're talking about, and American forces. Does this intersect with the president's call for more war powers?
In a way, what we're hearing are reports that the Islamic State has taken over much of the town of al-Baghdadi, which is in the always restive Anbar province, about 35 miles northwest of Ramadi, where there's a major U.S. base called El Asad, where they are training Iraqi forces and where about 300 U.S. service members are right now. As it is, before they had control of this town, the base was taking about two or three low-scale attacks a week. And now there was hope that that the air campaign was having an effect on the Islamic State, was weakening the Islamic State. And here that they were able to take another town in Anbar seems to dash some of those hopes that that the strikes were really weakening them. I would also argue that it speaks to their need to grab land, because that land is critical for economic resources, for even quality of life resources like food and other supplies.
Nancy, you know this terrain better than I. Am I mixing two things here? Is the Marine base in a separate location from the Baghdad airport? These two advances, am I putting them together or are they the same?
No, so there's the Baghdad airport, which is in the westernmost part of Baghdad. And then the province just west next to that on the west side is Anbar. And so that base, that El Asad, is there to train, frankly, Sunni fighters, because one of the challenges that the Iraqi military has had is that it is primarily Shia. And if the Iraqis have any hope of taking back terrain from the Islamic State in places like Mosul and Anbar, it needs a Sunni-dominated force. And so those troops have been tasked with working with Sunni fighters in particular. So the airport is, I'd say about 50 miles east of that point where Baghdadi is, that city that was taken over.
What a complicated scenario here, where they have to go in and train Sunni fighters separately. And are those even in the Iraqi army? Let's get everything clarified here. Or are those, like the Sunni awakening, the Arab awakening, just tribal fighters?
So frankly, what happened was, when former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was in charge, he did not trust Sunnis, particularly commanders. You know, remember that under Saddam Hussein, it was a majority Sunni force, and so a lot of your leadership was Sunni dominated. And then the U.S. started training forces and trying to build a force that was really representative of the population, which is about 20% Sunni, 20% Kurd, and 60% Shia. And once he became prime minister, he was very distrusting of those Sunni commanders, and so he moved a lot of them out. And so by the time the Islamic State showed up on June 10th and ran through Mosul, those forces, having no leadership, having no real support from the central
collapsed.
Government, collapsed to the point that they literally had civilian clothes under their uniforms and literally walked away. Now, frankly, had they fought, I don't think it was such an insurmountable force if you'd had an army there with the kind of resources and training to take them on.
Boy, all of this is the very complex background. And it sounds like we're right back in that Iraq scenario. The president saying this week with his formal request for new authorization for the use of military force from Congress, saying this is not going to be like it was. We don't want to get dragged back into all this. Here was the president on Wednesday.
I'm convinced that the United States should not get dragged back into another prolonged ground war in the Middle East. That's not in our national security interest, and it's not necessary for us to defeat ISIL. Local forces on the ground who know their country's best are best positioned to take the ground fight to ISIL, and that's what they're doing.
Brian Tao in Washington. Here's the request from the president. Of course, the fighting is already going on. We've got Marines there training. We've got plenty of airstrikes, 1,900, nearly 2,000 in the last 6 months. What do you make of the reception that the president's request has received on Capitol Hill? They're going off on recess, but then there'll be a lot of talk and debate here. Is he going to get the authorization for the use of military force that he wants?
Well, the real question and the real interesting thing about this is it's not really clear that he needs it. The White House has been pretty adamant that they already have the military authority that they need based on some earlier resolutions from the Bush administration. And whatever reception this gets on Capitol Hill, and it's been a relatively chilly one, but it's not clear that the White House and the Pentagon even need new authority. But on the other hand, the president says that it's time to update some of the laws that underpin the war on terror. It's time to bring these laws up to date to face new threats like Islamic State. And that's what this current resolution is about. As for the reception on Capitol Hill, Democrats are really worried about some of the scope of the potential resolution. For example, they note there's no geographical limitation and that some of the language is unclear. On the other hand, Republicans say it actually ties the president's hands too much. So this is going to be an interesting congressional debate as it unfolds.
I mean, you've heard Republicans, Lindsey Graham, saying, whereas the president's saying no big ground operations, he's saying we absolutely need those. They don't want restrictions on the commander-in-chief in this theater. Here he was on Face the Nation last week, CBS.
An aerial campaign will not destroy ISIL. You're going to need boots on the ground, not only in Iraq, but Syria. And there's got to be some regional force formed with an American component, somewhere around 10,000, I think, American soldiers to align with the Arab armies in the region and go into Syria and take back territory from ISIL. That's what will make it stop.
10,000, will that stop it? Maybe once you get to 10,000, do you need 20? But Democrats worried about giving this authorization that it may not be as limiting as the White House presented it. Democratic Congressman from California, Adam Schiff, talked about those concerns right here.
It's the administration's intention that this new authorization should serve not to broaden its authority, but as a limiting force. But the reality is, without a sunset on the old authorization, it doesn't limit this administration or the next. The other major issue is the language to ground troops, which is very broad, very ambiguous.
No enduring offensive ground combat operations, says the request. Jack Beatty, we've got a bunch of debates going on here at once, and sometimes at cross purposes. There are those in Congress who want the president to feel that he must come, whoever it is, that he must come for congressional sign-off before taking the country to war. On the other hand, you know, many presidents have gone without it. And you've got the whole issue of how heavy or light or not at all people even want to get into this arena again, Jack.
Yes. And you have a public now, 48% of Americans, according to a recent poll, think that President Obama will be more remembered for starting a war than for ending two wars. So in his reputation, this is a crucial moment. And looking at that resolution that he sent, you know, it seeks permission to attack, quote, associated persons or forces of ISIS anywhere. There's no geographic limit to that. Well, such forces all over the world, you know, jihad, or at least all over that part of the world, people are claiming we're with ISIS.
Yes.
In Libya, in Yemen, wherever it is.
In Paris.
In Paris. And does that mean we go after them then? You know, the whole thing has a kind of skein of disaster built into it and of endless war. I mean, it literally is endless war. There's no three years, but in 3 years they just come back to the Congress. What Congress is going to pull the plug on forces engaged at whatever level of violence against ISIS?
Nancy Youssef, what's your assessment of how this fight is going so far? Can the president stay on the path he's on and contain ISIS, or is Lindsey Graham's appeal for more ground troops going to gain strength if ISIS doesn't retreat or expands?
Well, a couple of things. So the U.S. has said that it's killed 6,000 ISIS fighters in the time that it began prosecuting this war 6 months ago. There's an estimated 4,000 fighters that have come in and replaced them. So on the face of it, that's a bad sign. Now, some would argue that those fighters are not as sophisticated or well-trained as the ones that the U.S. killed. ISIS has been able to gain land mass in places like Syria. Now, a lot of that land mass is rural areas. They didn't really have to fight for it. It wasn't contested. And so the sort of counterargument is that it's not as valuable as it seems, and they weren't able to take Kobani, that when they have faced
the little town on the Syria-Turkish border that was so heavily fought over.
That's right, and what they were really keen to get. And now the difference is in Kobani, they faced a very aggressive Kurdish force, and in other parts of Syria, they haven't. So what we've seen is that when they face a durable, if you will, ground force, that they are not able to win a war of attrition. But they so far have not faced that. At the minimum, the strikes seem to be containing their efforts to expand their grip other than Baghdadi, but that's in an area that was relatively uncontested for them, that they have been able to contain them. But the president's goal of degrading and defeating the Islamic State so far doesn't seem to be happening, that they've stopped the momentum that they were on in the summer, but not so much that they can't come back.
And what is that durable force going to be that might oppose them? Will the pressure mount to make it an American force, whatever the president says now? Nancy Youssef with The Daily Beast, it's great to have you. Please stand by in Washington. And Brian Tao of The Wall Street Journal there. Jack Beatty, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, a war powers request, eyeball to eyeball over Ukraine. Can always be a fuse here to get us more involved. There was Kayla Mueller and confirmation of her death. ISIS says under Jordanian bombardment in Syria. That's been disputed, but photographic evidence, yes, she's dead. Her aunt, Lori Lyon, spoke to the press.
Kayla has touched the heart of the world. The world grieves with us. The world mourns with us. The world wants to be more like Kayla.
The world wants to be more like Kayla. Well, Kayla's gone right now. And a very great family pain you can hear right there. I want to go to our listeners on the whole authorization of force question. David in Stanton, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. My comment is this. We need to work with Iran and the Assad regime in Syria, even though we don't like them and it's not politically popular. We need to, just like Winston Churchill said when Hitler invaded Russia, that if Hitler invaded hell, he'd have something good to say about the devil on the floor of the House of Commons. And we need to put it on them and the UAE and Jordan and all those countries and support them, but it's their fight, and we need to support them. And
David, we've got it, and ally with whomever it takes to get the job done. Brian Tao, how about that? Our caller David says, work with Iran, work with Assad in Syria, who has been so deeply denounced by the White House and the State Department over time. Is the White House softening on the need to work potentially with even these actors in the region, Brian?
Well, you know, I definitely think it puts the Obama administration in a strange place. We heard, the State Department spokeswoman yesterday, Jen Psaki, repeating the call for Bashar al-Assad to go at the same time Bashar al-Assad's forces are engaged against ISIS fighters. And, it's true that Iran has provided military and, other assistance against Islamic State, even if they're not directly working with Western countries. They're conducting their own military strikes. They're involved in this conflict. So, you know, this conflict is making for very strange bedfellows. And, you know, while the administration pursues a nuclear deal with Iran, while they're trying to pressure the Assad regime to end a civil war there, they're also fighting a common enemy in ISIS. And it is really a very strange and complicated issue that the rise of Islamic State or ISIS has caused.
Nancy Youssef, are they really still pressuring Assad to end that civil war, or do they want him now in there banging away at certainly at ISIS? Is the U.S. willing to work with him? Are we working with him?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen sort of a softening of that position. Remember, early on in this war, which began in 2011, President Obama came out and said Assad must go. And then John Kerry came out just recently this week and wasn't as aggressive in his language. Assad is so confident that he's giving interviews this week to BBC in which he presents himself as a great statesman and defender of the
state.
No
barrel bombs. And
that's right. And that he has communicated through third parties with the United States, although on not tactical issues. And so what you're seeing in this conflict is that allies that the U.S. once considered have now switched. For example, the most notable is Nusra, which the United States considered working with 2 years ago, is now aligned with the Islamic State. And so I think what's happening is that in the absence of an idea of how the state stays cohesive and secure, in the absence of the Assad regime, that there's no obvious sort of successor or governing institution that could take over, that there's a lot more room for, as David calls for, negotiations, working with parties and trying to come up with some sort of solution.
We're going to have to move on from this one. There's so much more news this week, but we will hear a lot more debate out of Congress on this request from the president. Of course, in the news at home, Kayla Mueller there back here. We had three bright-eyed young Muslim Americans killed, execution style, nearly all shot in the head in Chapel Hill. The police are saying over a parking dispute. Families are disputing that. Let's just hear the voice of one of those killed this week. This is 21-year-old Yusra Abu Salah, killed this past week in Chapel Hill. She was talking here with a former teacher, Sister Jabin, in a StoryCorps booth last year. 46-year-old Craig Stephen Hicks has been arrested in connection to the murders. Here's the young woman talking just last year, young American woman, Muslim American, about life in this country.
I feel so embedded in the fabric that is, you know, our culture. And
Absolutely.
That's the beautiful thing here is that it doesn't matter where you come from. There's so many different people from so many different places and of different backgrounds and religions.
Absolutely.
But here we're all one.
All one. Now she's dead, along with two others in her immediate circle there. And her father yesterday, Dr. Muhammad Yusuf Abu Salah, father of two of those slain women, the two sisters. Here he was at a funeral yesterday in Raleigh, North Carolina.
This has hate crime written all over it.
And it is not hard to see how he would feel that way. At a news conference on Wednesday, Karen Hicks, wife of the alleged killer, said her husband did not commit a hate crime. It was all about parking.
I can say with my absolute belief that this incident had nothing to do with religion or victim's faith, but in fact was related to the long-standing parking disputes that my husband had with the neighbors.
Nancy Youssef, I know this is not your beat. I know North Carolina is not your turf, but you know Muslim American life, and you surely are paying attention. I mean, Twitter has just blown up with this. Everybody's paying so much attention here to what's just happened. How are you seeing what's just come down here, Nancy?
Well, I have to tell you, it was sort of incredible to hear someone say the triple homicide wasn't about hate; it was about a parking space. You know, it's quite a defense, and I can tell you that, you know, because there's been so much news coming out of the Islamic State, and there's such tension in the Muslim American community about where people fit in, that I think there was an assumption that it went there. We know that the FBI is now investigating it for hate crime, but it's worrisome in the climate that we live in sort of a polarized climate where people are so angry about the Islamic State. And I get the sense from the Muslim community that there's a sense of loss about where one belongs in a way that wasn't there just even a few years ago. And so that when the news came out, it was very hard to believe that someone would commit a triple homicide over in a parking space, particularly given the climate that we are living in right now.
It is so appalling. Jack Beatty, you see the faces of these three ambitious, bright young people, recently married, in school and going to school and just sort of following the American dream, and boom, I'm sorry to even use that word, but all three gone in an instant. This is a terrible tragedy for the family and terrible timing for the country, it seems to me, Jack.
Oh, and undoubtedly. And you know, it has a local context. Duke University canceled the Muslim call to prayer. They had been doing this apparently for some time, but after the Charlie Hebdo massacre, they decided to cancel it because of pressure from Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, who, you know, said we can't be having calls to prayer for Muslims when Muslims are doing these awful things in Paris. And that seemed to have, that I'm not saying there's anything causal about that, but that is a local charged issue in the background here. But in the foreground, we have the American berserker, you know, Craig Hicks, as the Times puts it in their lead today, irritated about noise, irascible about parking, hostile to religion, and armed.
I don't know exactly how long that call to prayer was up, if it even got up, but yes, that would. But there's so much in the air here. I mean, you just look anywhere. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Aisha. Aisha, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. My comment is for the students in North Carolina, and I'm appalled that people are suggesting that it's not a hate crime. It's definitely a hate crime because he shot and killed all three. He could have shot one and then be done with it. But the fact that he killed all three of them execution style and shows the hypocrisy of the people, because when the reporters were killed in Paris, everybody stood up and condemned the killing. But it's been kind of quiet here over these three students, and it's just a shame to me.
It is shocking. It is shocking. I mean, Byron Tao, the word was that Mr. Hicks was an angry man. Many of his neighbors said as much. But this is a rough moment for this, resonating around the country, and a terrible moment for these families and the community in Chapel Hill.
You know, that's right. I think the Times reporting did hint at the fact that, he did obviously express a lot of anger towards all sorts of people. He did make his neighbors of all races uncomfortable. But this comes at a time when the United States is struggling with, Islamophobia and the integration of Muslims into American society. And, President Obama even spoke about this a few weeks ago. He said that unlike in Europe, American Muslims do feel a part of this country. They do feel accepted, that we haven't had the troubles of integrating Muslim Americans into the fabric of this country. And then we have something like this, something in a small community in North Carolina that really, raises a lot of tensions and questions about some of these bigger problems.
Timing couldn't be worse. We will pay more attention to this triple murder and what it means. I want to turn to Ukraine. Lots of difficult negotiation there, 16-hour stretch, and then at the very last minute, word of a ceasefire is scheduled for Saturday night. Still a lot of skepticism about whether or how this might hold. On Monday, President Obama was saying that Russia hadn't followed the previous Minsk agreement signed just last September, which was supposed to halt the war in Ukraine. Here's the president.
It's clear that they violated just about every commitment they made in the Minsk agreement. Instead of withdrawing from eastern Ukraine, Russian forces continue to operate there, training separatists and helping to coordinate attacks. Instead of withdrawing its arms, Russia has sent in more tanks and armored personnel carriers and heavy artillery.
Lots of artillery in eastern Ukraine at this point. Here was German Chancellor Angela Merkel was saying there's a glimmer of hope out of these talks in Belarus.
We now have a glimmer of hope. We agreed on a comprehensive implementation of Minsk, but concrete steps must of course be taken, and big hurdles still lie ahead of us.
A glimmer of hope, maybe at best. Nancy Youssef, what is the expectation out of this? The last agreement really came to nothing. I mean, the fighting just kept on cranking up. We're told that much more equipment came across the border from Russia into this zone. Does the context look different this time, Nancy?
Well, a couple of things. The they're calling this Minsk II. So, and it was a continuation, if you will, of Minsk I. As you point out, that ceasefire didn't hold at all. And this was a really desperate effort, frankly, by France and Germany, who are so adamantly opposed to suggestions by the United States of giving the Ukrainians defensive weapons, anti-tank missiles, ammunition even, as a means to fend off the aggression by these Russian-backed separatists. And so you mentioned the president's comments earlier, and he was speaking with Angela Merkel standing right next to him. And this week we had thought that there would be an announcement about whether the United States would give additional arms, defensive arms, to the Ukrainians. And then Angela Merkel came in and spent 16 hours with Putin, with Poroshenko, trying to iron out this deal. What's interesting about it is we have a ceasefire that's supposed to begin midnight Saturday. And the border, the Russian border, is supposed to be put back, if you will, by the end of 2015, that the big, big issues were really kicked down the road, that this was, it took 16 hours and a very glum-looking meeting of Russia and Germany, Ukraine, and France to get this deal together. And they couldn't really deal with the big, big issues. Crimea didn't come up. The peninsula which fell out of Ukrainian hands, the withdrawal of Russian weapons and troops and equipment, that wasn't really dealt with. And so this was a very, very, very small step towards hopefully, optimistically dealing with the substantive issues, the core issues that led to the beginning of this conflict.
What does it even mean to put the border back, as you say, Nancy, when apparently, manpower and all kinds of equipment have just flowed across it? Does it mean Ukrainian military forces or border forces back on those borders, roads closed, the free flow of troops and munitions over?
And that the Russians honor that border and not send over weapons and other equipment and troops to Ukrainian separatists. That there's an acknowledgement that the state as it exists should be recognized as such by Russia.
Boy, it's hard to be very believing on that front. But here was the Russian President Vladimir Putin speaking in Minsk after the announcement of the ceasefire, interpreted by Euronews. Excuse me.
We are calling on both sides to exercise restraint and do everything to ensure the withdrawal of troops and heavy weapons happens without bloodshed and casualties, which nobody wants. We have agreed with President Poroshenko of Ukraine that we will give the order.
The order, I guess, for ceasefire. Byron Tao, is the White House lined up with France and Germany here? Do they have any confidence in what's just been negotiated?
Well, you know, the White House has said that their position hasn't changed. They're waiting. They're withholding judgment to see how the ceasefire comes into effect. They said that if Russia does follow this new Minsk agreement, that it is possible that we could see a rollback of sanctions and an unwinding of other economic measures that have really crippled the Russian economy. But they're not. They're also not optimistic, given that we have seen and we've reached an agreement on similar issues a few months ago, and it didn't seem to do much to end the conflict. And what's difficult for them in this case is that there really isn't a good military solution here. And they've even acknowledged as much. They've acknowledged that even military aid to Ukraine, it wouldn't be given in the idea of defeating the Russian army, which is quite formidable. And they are, of course, a nuclear power. So this is a really tough situation for them. And despite what some Republicans in Congress think, there's really not much of a military solution here.
Jack Beatty, do you expect something that would close the gap so far, huge, between word and deed in eastern Ukraine?
It may be a moment for creative fudging. President Poroshenko was in a unique dilemma. The IMF was going to, in fact, now come forward with a $17 billion bailout, but that was conditioned on stability. And he was facing the choice. If I'm going to fight the Russians and try to get back the 200 square miles or so they have captured since the rebels have captured since September, I'm going to have to create a state of emergency. That will be the end of any chance of a bailout. So I think he chose the financial possibilities over the drastic attack.
The world will watch when the ceasefire is supposed to go into effect Saturday at midnight. Jack Beatty, Byron Tao, Nancy Youssef, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, more than 6 feet of snow now in Boston. Aging public transit breaking down. An exasperated transit chief, Beverly Scott, announced she'll quit, but not before saying you get what you pay for.
What you have got to do is that you've got to give that person, or whoever they are, Guy Jr. or whomever, give them the resources that they need, and that means that there has to be significant investment and reinvestment in this system.
On Wednesday, Little League International stripped the Jackie Robinson West Little League team in Chicago of its U.S. championship title because the team had used players from outside its district. Little Leaguer Brandon Green wasn't having it.
We know that we're champions, our parents know we're champions, and the team's parents know we're champions, and Chicago knows we're champions.
That's right.
But the trophy is going, and at the Grammys Sunday night, British singer Sam Smith won 4 top awards, including the coveted Record of the Year.
I want to thank the man who this record is about, who I fell in love with last year. Thank you so much for breaking my heart, because you got me 4 Grammys.
Oh, won't you stay with me, because you're all I need.
We're looking at a week in the news with Nancy Youssef of the Daily Beast, Byron Tao of the Wall Street Journal, and Jack Beattie. Federal judge says, Alabama? Time for gay marriage. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court there in Alabama telling the local courts, no, don't do it. Here he was earlier this week, Chief Justice Roy Moore in Alabama defending his decision to issue an order forbidding probate judges from issuing marriage licenses to gay couples despite that federal ruling.
I submit to you that 36 states did not legalize same-sex marriage. It's been done by federal courts who've usurped the rights in jurisdiction of the state government.
Now we've got another statement by the court and some of those marriages beginning to happen more widely in Alabama. Byron Tao, again, how's the White House looking at this? Is this George Wallace in the in the doorway here with the National Guard in the wings? Are we back to that kind of dynamic, or how is Washington expecting this to play out?
Well, I don't want to bore your listeners, but the judge in Alabama, Roy Moore, does have some very technical legal points in his favor. Essentially, it's a dispute over federal and state power, and now that we have a new ruling from the federal court, it may have cleared a lot of those technical points up and really moved forward towards bringing gay marriage to Alabama.
What has happened there? What's the new ruling? You mean since the first one that he defied? What's the further advance?
Right. So a federal district court judge in January ruled that Alabama would have to start issuing gay marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And, Roy Moore essentially said that a district court judge does not have authority over the state, that such a ruling would need to come from a higher court, a federal circuit court or the U.S. Supreme Court. And that order did not get handed down. So what happened was that plaintiffs went back and named probate court judges, lower court Alabama judges, as the plaintiff in the lawsuit, forcing them to be the recipients of an order. As I said, it's a very technical argument over the legality here. But the latest ruling, which came this week, should really clear things up. So if there are any probate judges that are refusing to grant marriage licenses across the state of Alabama, they are now in violation of a direct order from a federal court. And we'll see how that plays out over the next few days. And it really did put a lot of these judges in a unique position. On one hand, they were getting an order from the top judge in their state to follow. On the other hand, they were getting an order from a federal court judge, and it wasn't exactly clear whose order it was, whose order was more legal. And so it really did put some of these judges in an interesting position.
Jack Beattie, there may have been technical points here, but it sounded like a good old-fashioned or bad old-fashioned, depending how you look at it, states' rights argument, the kind we heard vigorously in the civil rights era as Justice Moore articulated it.
It sure does, and a Alabama writer, Diane McWhorter, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, commented on that. She saw a resemblance, a similitude between George Wallace, Atticus Finch, the lawyer in To Kill a Mockingbird, and Judge Moore. She said, what they have in common is that their heroism is bound up in the futility of their cause. In Alabama, it's like our oxygen is defiance and our identity is aggrievement. So it's a very Alabama moment here.
Let's go to Norman in Cleveland, Ohio. Norman, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you, are you related to John Ashbrook, who is a Congress guy from Cleveland?
You know, way back in the family tree, family's been in the country since 1682. I think that it's about 200 years ago that branch, we peeled off in separate directions. But yes, if you go far enough back.
Okay. My comment is, first of all, with the Civil War, are you an Alabaman first or are you an American first? And the Supreme Court, didn't they say that if you have deeply held religious beliefs, then you may act on them? In other words, a person doesn't have to, a proprietor doesn't have to serve a gay customer. I'm wondering if that's going to work for African American customers. But you know, I don't agree with it. But isn't that a possibility?
I don't know if you're going to outstrip our legal expertise here today. Byron, I'm going to come back to you on this. Do you see wiggle room here? I mean, Judge Moore, he's got quite a history. He's the guy who put the big Ten Commandments statue right in the lobby of the courthouse there and had the whole fight over that. An exemption for probate court officials when they're supposed to marry people if they really don't feel like it?
I don't think there's much of a legal leg to stand on here. Now that we have a very clear district court order to a probate court judge in Alabama to start issuing marriage licenses to couples regardless of gender, this seems to clear things up. And we're moving towards a Supreme Court ruling, a nationwide Supreme Court ruling on this issue. They've agreed to hear four cases. They've combined them into one big hearing. And it's likely, you know, most political observers, most court watchers believe that it's likely that the court will find a nationwide right to same-sex marriage in the next few months.
Some hint from Clarence Thomas this week in that direction. Not that he would join it, but that he may anticipate it coming. I want to look at the Department of Homeland Security and funding there for Congress headed out on recess soon. There has been a lot going on back and forth here over the funding and the Republicans trying to use, I guess, this necessary funding for Homeland Security as leverage to overturn executive orders on immigration by President Obama. Nancy Youssef, where does this stand now on Capitol Hill?
I actually am not quite the best person to talk to about that because I've been so consumed with the Islamic State I couldn't answer it with any proper authority.
Fair enough. Worthy of being consumed by Jack, have you followed this closely?
Yes, this gets back to, wouldn't you know it, the filibuster. When the Democrats were in the majority, they complained, they keen night and day, oh my God, the tyranny of the minority, the Republican filibuster. Well, now they have turned, now suddenly they find the virtue in the filibuster. And three times last week, they filibustered this essentially House bill that would have limited funding, that would have gone ahead with funding for the most of the Department of Homeland Security, but not the proportion dedicated to the president fulfilling President Obama's promise about expanding rights for undocumented workers. And so three times is a pretty straightforward record of failure. Mitch McConnell looked at John Boehner and he said, gee, we can't get anything going here. You guys have got to come up with another bill. And they only have about a week or so, maybe a little more, to do it. And it may be that they're headed, that the House Republicans are headed toward a shutdown, a partial shutdown of the government. That is, that they will not fund the Department of Homeland Security because of this issue of immigration. And some people see that as a disaster in the making right now. They have the choice. They can send the president a clean bill, which would just be funding the department. That would be capitulation. They can fudge it. They can say, well, we'll go ahead 6 months or something, and then we'll come back. But that just kicks the can down the road. Or they can just defy him and say, we're going to shut the whole department down. It's not a propitious time to shut down the Department of Homeland Security with ISIS rampant. So they're in a tough spot.
Speaker John Boehner fulminating mightily about all this week. Here he is.
The House did its job. We won the fight to fund the Department of Homeland Security and to stop the president's unconstitutional actions. Now it's time for the Senate to do their work. You know, in a gift shop out here, they've got these little booklets on how a bill becomes a law, right? The House has done its job. Now, why don't you go ask the Senate Democrats when they're going to get off their ass and do something other than to vote no?
John Boehner really on a tear this week there on funding for Homeland Security. Also on the Keystone Pipeline, a bill went through this week, sent to the president's desk. President Obama has said that he will veto it. Earlier on Wednesday, here was Boehner again talking, about exactly that.
The president is standing with a bunch of left fringe extremists and anarchists. The president needs to listen to the American people and say, yes, let's build the Keystone Pipeline.
Byron Tao, left fringe extremists and anarchists opposing the Keystone Pipeline. Is that right?
Well, you know, certainly environmental groups have not been fans of this project. They say that it would, it would increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and would increase our reliance on foreign oil. Essentially, it's Canadian oil. But
are they anarchists, for heaven's sakes?
I certainly would not go that far. But who am I to disagree with the speaker? But the White House certainly will veto this bill. And they've said two things about it. First is that they say it's their prerogative to decide which pipelines get approved, not Congress's. And the second is that they've been very skeptical that this project would do what some of the developers and some of its supporters say it would do.
Got James Comey, head of the FBI, talking this week about law enforcement and the difficulties with that. Here's a little sound of him saying that there's a history here that the FBI has to come to terms with.
All of us in law enforcement must be honest enough to acknowledge that much of our history is not pretty. At many points in American history, law enforcement enforced the status quo, a status quo that was often brutally unfair to disfavored groups.
Jack Beatty, this is a tone that I do not recall from a head of the FBI before, and he went on at some length about it this week. He's got new recruits to the FBI now visiting the MLK Memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C., I'm told. This is a new sound.
It is indeed. And, of course, Mr. Comey, we remember him from the Bush administration. He had a shining moment of integrity when in the Justice Department he essentially shut down he prevented a miscarriage of justice that the Bush White House desperately wanted to carry through. So he's a man of integrity. And here he spoke about the American dilemma. Everyone's a little bit racist, he said, quoting from the Q?
The Broadway show.
Yep. Yeah, and he said, it's ridiculous that I can't tell you how many people were shot by the police last week, last month, last year, calling for data to be kept on that. We don't have data. And he also said, looking at the racial, it's time we start seeing one another for who and what we really are. Look past the stereotype, look to the person. And he was received very well by police departments around the country in a way that Eric Holder saying very similar things was not. And one reason, I think, is he said policemen get into this job because they care. They want to help people. And, you know, it's worth remembering that Darren Wilson, the officer who killed from Ferguson. Michael Brown there. Just before he went on after the call, answered the call that finally led to the killing of Michael Brown, he was helping to revive a 2-year-old child that couldn't breathe. And, you know, he was partly in police work to help people. And I think the policemen hearing that, you know, you're not responsible for racism in America, but sometimes you act out of stereotypical fears. We all have to work through them. But you know what? You're in the business you are in because fundamentally you want to help people. I think that helped.
Good to remember the whole spectrum there. Media in news in a huge way this week. Brian Williams out for 6 months at NBC. Jon Stewart says he'll step down from The Daily Show. Longtime CBS correspondent Bob Simon dead in a car crash in Manhattan. And then just in the last 24 hours, David Carr, The New York Times, the towering media critic there gone. Here was Lester Holt on Wednesday, anchor coming in for Brian Williams. NBC Nightly News no longer with Brian Williams, announcing a 6-month suspension.
Brian Williams, anchor and managing editor of Nightly News, has been suspended by NBC management for 6 months without pay. In a statement, NBC News President Deborah Turner said on Friday, January 30th, Brian misrepresented events which occurred while he was covering the Iraq War in 2003.
Out for 6 months. We'll see if he comes back. On Tuesday night, Jon Stewart announced he would be leaving Comedy Central's The Daily Show in the near future, sometime later this year.
This show doesn't deserve an even slightly restless host. And neither do you. I don't think I'm going to miss being on television every day. I'm going to miss coming here every day.
Jack Beatty, this feels to me like kind of maybe Stewart more than Williams, kind of an earthquake in what we've come to see as the media pantheon.
Yes, it really does. And Stewart is inimitable. You know, you just can't. His qualities just seem so hard to match. But with all of that, you know, I'm as impressed by the reporting and the dogged effort to put facts in context that The Daily Show evinces every single day. And let me give you just a recent example on the Alabama case. They quoted Judge Moore and others basically saying, well, yes, we have constitutional objections, but finally this comes down to the Bible. Finally, this comes down to, you know, prohibitions in the Bible against same-sex marriage. For a second, he halted and he said, no, wait a minute, where have we heard that before? Then he went to the November election when 75% of Alabamans voted to ban Sharia law, effectively, within the state of Alabama. They called it foreign law. And then, so he puts it in that context, and then he says, now what could be foreign law? Where would that... My heavens, where was the Bible written? Was that Judea, Samaria? I mean, the point is, that's the kind of brilliant context they do every day.
A number of brilliant folks in the media lost this week. John Stewart, just off the air. David Carr, The New York Times. Wow, big loss there. Bob Simon with all his reporting. And we'll see what happens with Brian Williams. What a week in the media. We'll talk more about it. Byron Tao at The Wall Street Journal. It's great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy Youssef at The Daily Beast. Always wonderful to have you, Nancy. Thank you.
It's a real honor. Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.